This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Later in the hour, we'll be talking to Shane Salerno, who has written a book and directed a new documentary about the life and work of acclaimed author J.D. Salinger. But first, state health officials believe they'll find more homes in and around Rutland County contaminated with chlorpyrifos. That's a banned insecticide that was allegedly used inside hundreds of homes by the company AAA-accredited Pest Control of North Clarendon. Six households have been displaced because of health concerns, and five others have been told to relocate. VPR's Nina Keck joins us now with more on the situation in Rutland County. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Mitch.
Now, what is the problem with this pesticide? Why are health officials so worried about it?
Well, chlorpyrifos is an organophosphate that was first introduced as an insecticide in 1965, and it's still used outdoors for agriculture purposes, but it's been banned for indoor use since 2001, except for childproof containers, the ant and roach baits that you can buy. But you just can't spray this chlorpyrifos stuff indoors anymore. And the reason it was banned is it was found to be toxic for humans. Chronic exposure has been linked to neurological effects, autoimmune disorders, as well as developmental disorders, and it's especially dangerous for pregnant women.
So how did the state discover that this banned pesticide was being used in the first place?
Well, the story goes back to late April, when a family in Rutland was having problems getting rid of bedbugs. And according to State Agency of Agriculture documents, this family called Carrie Buck, the owner of AAA-accredited Pest Control. And he guaranteed that he'd get rid of the bugs. The family hired him, and Buck treated three floors of their home, and he left a service ticket indicating that he'd used two EPA-registered products. But the family noticed a strong kerosene-like odor that wouldn't go away. So about a week after their home was treated by Carrie Buck, they were concerned enough to call the state. And the Agency of Agriculture, the department that oversees pesticide use, sent out field agents to investigate. They ended up taking extensive swab samples from all over the house, and when those swabs were analyzed by the state lab, the Agency of Agriculture says they found samples indicating that Buck had used several pesticides at 100 and 500 times the labeled rate. They also found very high levels of the banned pesticide chlorpyrifos, including one area that showed a level 3,000 times the legal rate when the pesticide is used for outdoor purposes.
That sounds pretty serious. Did Carrie Buck actually admit to using the banned pesticide?
No. When those same field agents came to his warehouse, Buck denied that he used any product containing chlorpyrifos, and he said he hadn't applied the insecticide in 8 or 9 years. But upon inspection, it was found that Buck had a supply of liquid and dry pesticides containing chlorpyrifos in storage at his business, and that chlorpyrifos was detected in his 50-gallon power spray tank. And he only had one of these that he uses in his business. So at that point, the state decided it better start testing some of Buck's other customers.
Well, how many homes do they need to test now, and how many have been found to be contaminated so far?
Well, by law, Carrie Buck had to keep customer invoices going back 2 years, and he turned those over to the state, as well as some customer lists that went back even further. Carrie Jaguer is an agrochemical expert with the Agency of Agriculture, and he told me last week that they had a list of about 262 homes and apartments that they wanted to look at, and about 92 of those have been tested so far. And he said 3 out of every 10 homes that they have tested have come back positive for chlorpyrifos, though contamination levels, he says, have varied a lot.
Has anyone gotten sick from this?
Well, at this point, no. And I think, Mitch, that's the silver lining in this whole story. No one has approached the health department saying that they have symptoms that they think are related to the pesticide. But State Health Commissioner Harry Chen said last week he believes most of the severest contamination situations have probably already found. Still, though, they need to keep testing to make sure that they know that for sure.
Now, Nina, you report that testing the homes of former customers has caused a pretty overwhelming workload for the agriculture agency. So I understand the EPA is now stepping in to help?
Right. Last week, about a dozen field agents from the EPA's Boston Bureau arrived in Rutland to help with the testing itself. And I had a chance to talk with one of them. His name is Tom Condon.
We've been working with the Vermont Department of Health and the Agency of Agriculture on building a database for managing all of the data that's being generated so that it can provide for a variety of different needs that ourselves and the state agencies will have.
So that database is a big deal, Mitch, because compiling a database is very, very important. Yet, As you can imagine, it's incredibly labor-intensive work. So the EPA's help there is a big deal for the state. The EPA may also bring in a mobile lab, which should speed up the process as well.
And Nina, what about the contaminated houses? Which agency is going to develop the cleanup plan for those?
The EPA says they'll develop a plan for the most seriously contaminated houses and apartments, and they say that may take weeks, if not months, to figure out. Again, here's EPA's Tom Condon.
This is an unusual situation for us in that under most situations, we're dealing with contamination in the environment. This is indoor contamination that puts it in a special and unusual category for us.
Now, what about Carrie Buck, the owner of AAA? Is he going to face any criminal charges for this?
Well, that remains to be seen. The state attorney general's office and the EPA's criminal division both say that they are investigating the matter, but they wouldn't go any further than that. And as I said earlier, Mr. Buck has denied using chlorpyrifos. I was unable to reach him for comment for my reporting on this, despite repeated attempts at his business and at his home. And I was also unable to get any comment from his lawyer, Bernard Lembeck.
Does that mean that Carrie Buck and AAA-accredited pest control is actually still in business right now?
No. The state did suspend Buck's pesticide applicator license back in June. In part, they said, because they believe he violated Vermont law by applying a banned insecticide. But they also cited Buck's history of pesticide misuse. And according to Agency of Agriculture documents, Buck has been fined several times, dating back to 1990, for failing to follow pesticide guidelines. And, Mitch, one other complicating factor in all of this. On July 29th of this year, Carrie Buck was arrested in Rutland for driving under the influence. And because Mr. Buck has two prior DUI convictions, he's now facing up to 5 years in prison if he's convicted.
Well, Nina, thanks very much for the update.
You're welcome.
And listeners, if you think your home may be at risk or if you have concerns about chlorpyrifos, we've posted the toll-free number for the Vermont Health Department's Environmental Health Division on our website, vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, sitting in for Jane Lindholm. What really knocks me out is a book that, when you're all done reading it, you wish the author that wrote it was a terrific friend of yours and you could call him up on the phone whenever you felt like it. That doesn't happen much, though. Fans of the late J.D. Salinger will recognize that quote from the author's best-known work, the novel Catcher in the Rye. And there's an irony in that wish by its main character, Holden Caulfield, to sit down and chat with the author of a book he loved, because that's exactly what so many people around the world felt they wanted to do with J.D. Salinger, who himself wanted no part of any such intimacy. Salinger eventually became as well-known for his desire not to be well-known as he did for his writing. Even in Heartland, Vermont, where starting in 1966 he would show up at the Brick Church for wintertime Saturday night Heartland's famous roast beef suppers, he'd arrive well ahead of the 5 p.m. start time, but as kitchen manager Susan Riley notes, it wasn't to mingle.
He would get here, I would say 3 or 3:30. Usually his wife would leave him here and she would go home. And he would sit in the first chair at the top of the stairs, and he would read or he would write in his journal. And he really did not want to talk to people or anything. And for whatever reason, you know, we would say good evening or something like that, but we basically left them alone. But we eventually knew who he was and were very pleased that he enjoyed our dinner.
Of course, not everyone did let J.D. Salinger alone. The famously reclusive author spent the last half of his life in Cornish, New Hampshire, not far from the Connecticut River. His post office box was in Windsor, Vermont, and fans trying to track him down often started their search there, hoping to catch a glimpse of the writer or even corner him for an interview when he went to pick up his mail. Salinger was born in Manhattan in 1919. Catcher in the Rye has been a staple for high school English classes for more than half a century after its publication in 1951. Among his other works are Nine Stories, published in 1953, and Franny and Zooey in 1961. Shane Salerno is the co-author with David Shields of a new book on the life and work of the author called Salinger, and the director of a documentary of the same name. He joins us today from a studio in Los Angeles, where he also works as a screenwriter. Shane Salerno, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I should let our listeners know that we really appreciate you being with us today, because I understand On your way to the studio today, there was a bit of a traffic accident in front of you, a pretty serious one. I hope you're okay, first of all.
Everything's good, and I apologize for maybe being just a few minutes late.
Oh, please don't apologize. We're glad you're well, and I know that can be a little stressful, so we really do appreciate you getting in and having this discussion about J.D. Salinger with us today. The book is it's quite a tome. It's some 800 pages long. It's filled with information about this well-known author, and I want to start by saying that, you know, it's funny because his literary output wasn't necessarily prolific for a man who lived into his 90s, but his own life story, Salinger's life story, that itself could have been made into a novel. He served in World War II, for one thing, very much involved in combat. Can you start off by telling us what your book chronicles about the most dramatic parts of his Army service?
Well, very few people know that J.D. Salinger's first day of combat was D-Day. That was his introduction to combat, and I say introduction given that he was just prior to this, a kid who grew up at 1133 Park Avenue and was a privileged son and had never suffered and had no experience in his life to prepare him. Once he landed on D-Day, he participated in one form or another in a series of very, very famous and bloody battles, and those included San Lo, the Battle of the Hurricane Forest, Battle of the Bulge, the Hedgerows just after D-Day, which were, really what one soldier called just a meat grinder. He, at the end of his service, walked into a concentration camp, a subcamp of Dachau, and as a result of the cumulative trauma, checked himself into a mental institution at the end of the war.
The people that you interviewed for this book and movie, they do bring up this military service. And how much do they say this, in their opinion, informed much of his writing that we read later on in life?
Based on our 10 years of research for the film and the book, the consensus from everyone was that if it hadn't been for World War II, we would not be sitting here today talking about J.D. Salinger. It was the transformative trauma of his life. It made Jerome David Salinger, J.D. Salinger. Before the war, he was a serviceable short story writer. He never allowed those early stories to be published. He called them the gaucheries of his youth. After the war, we get Banana Fish, Esme, Catcher in the Rye, Franny and Zooey, the nine stories. That war changed him and shaped him in a profound way. It broke him as a man, which is why he needed time in that institution, but it made him as an artist. Some kind of bizarre literary alchemy happened, and the pain and the sorrow and the feelings that he expresses so elegantly and beautifully in his stories, those are a direct result of his service in World War II. World War II is really the ghost in the machine of J.D. Salinger's writing life.
It sounds like his wounds were psychological. He was lucky to escape really without any serious physical injuries, though, it sounds like.
He didn't have any physical injuries. He broke his nose, but he had serious psychological trauma. And in fact, from the 1940s well into the 1970s, was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. The men in World War II who fought in that war, they internalized everything that they experienced. They just took it inside themselves and kept those secrets. So we interviewed men who had never talked about battles they fought in, and we interviewed one man who said 65 years later he still sees bombs falling in his living room. And then he turned off camera to his wife, who was just behind me, and said, "I've never told my wife that." There was another gentleman that we interviewed who said whenever it snows, he starts to cry, a piece rather that's featured in the book, because it reminds me of the Battle of the Bulge and when the snow melted, the thousands of bodies that were buried there. So this war created Salinger, and you see it in the work. I mean, Catcher in the Rye is completely filled with World War II, Esme, Banana Fish, many of the nine stories having depression and suicide and having issues that were directly relatable to his service. He was a counterintelligence agent. He was not an infantryman, which was a really fascinating viewpoint that he had of war. And he lived his life for the next 45 years like a counterintelligence agent.
We're speaking with Shane Salerno, co-author of the new book Salinger and director of the documentary film of the same name. Listeners, you can join the conversation as well. Call us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also leave a post or question on our Vermont Edition Facebook page. Shane Salerno, you mentioned 10 years of gathering information about J.D. Salinger. Was it difficult to find people to speak with you about this reclusive author who wanted, for the most part, to be left alone?
Well, the great myth about J.D. Salinger is that he was a recluse. We show very clearly in the film and very clearly in the book that he was not a recluse. I mean, a recluse wouldn't, for instance, go to a church supper every Sunday. You wouldn't see Howard Hughes at a church supper every Sunday. What he was deeply private, and we respected that throughout the 10 years of making this film. We never hid in a bush or a tree or pursued him. He has very much that New Hampshire and Vermont ideal of privacy, and we deeply respected that. We were making a film of his life and a book of his life, as other people have done books on him. And we did pursue a number of people who knew him over the years and convinced them for the first time to speak on the record. So you have people in the film and in the book who are breaking a silence and speaking for the first time in 60 or 65 years. You have people sharing photos and letters that they've held on to for six decades. That took an enormous amount of time to convince them to share their stories with us. We spent 10 years on this. I was 30 when I started, 40 when I finished. I funded the movie entirely myself, initially intending to spend $300,000 and ended up spending $2 million of my own money. And it was a true labor of love. And it was never to take Salinger down or anything like that. It was to tell the story of his life. So many people know the work, but they don't know the life. They don't know, for instance, that J.D. Salinger landed on D-Day with six chapters of The Catcher in the Rye with him. While other guys were carrying pictures of their girlfriends or carrying something from home, J.D. Salinger was carrying six chapters of arguably the most famous anti-establishment book of all time. And I think that's an important part of the story. I think that J.D. Salinger checking himself into a mental institution at the end of World War II is a really important part of the story. If you understand that he lost the love of his life to Charlie Chaplin, which is a story very few people know, and that love was a woman, young woman named Una O'Neill, who was an extraordinary woman. You learn about love and loss and innocence that runs throughout all of Salinger's work. Between the ages of 16 and 18, Una O'Neill dated Peter Arno, the legendary New Yorker cartoonist, Orson Welles, J.D. Salinger, and then just after her 18th birthday, married Charlie Chaplin, mm-hmm. breaking Salinger's heart forever, and imprinting upon him an image of a girl right on the cusp of womanhood. And there were obviously a number of women that followed that in the decades that followed.
Yeah, I want to get into some of those other women. He had quite the prolific love life as well. And Una O'Neill, of course, the daughter of Eugene O'Neill, another great literary connection there, the famous playwright. After Salinger died in 2010, our VPR reporter, Susan Keese, spoke with some people in Vermont who had met Salinger. And one of them was Windsor resident Joyce Pierce. She was a teenager when she met Salinger at a lunch spot called Knapp's on Main Street. Here's what she had to say when asked whether Salinger met there with young people to get a sense of how they spoke for dialogue to use in his stories.
She'd already written about Holden Caulfield, so he kind of had that down pat. And any of the short stories, I don't recall that we could have helped him much with. So I really don't know. I don't know why he was drawn to young people like that.
What do you think about his being drawn to young people, and especially young women? I mean, one of the women that he did marry was Claire Douglas, whom he married in 1955 in Barnard, Vermont. She was only 16 when he first met her, and he was 31.
Yeah, I mean, just to step back to that great report that your reporter did, we have a much longer version in the book, and it unfortunately had to be cut from the film for time. But there was a period when he moved to Cornish, New Hampshire, and would go in every morning to the Windsor Post Office, which is where our film opens, and pick up his New York Times and get his mail. But there were a group of kids, and we interviewed one, and you obviously interviewed another, who were his friends, and he went to the Windsor High School football games with them. He had a Jeep and often drove them around, and he spent a lot of time with them at Knapp's lunch and actually brought them up to his house and played records. And one of those kids, a Windsor High School student, a high school student, a woman, girl, asked him if she could interview him for her high school paper, Windsor high school paper. And he said, sure, which was a big deal because he just didn't do interviews. And that story ended up running not in the Windsor paper as promised, but actually in a much larger paper. And when it did, he felt betrayed and built this fence, legendary fence that went around his property and never spoke to the kids again.
You can see that fence in your book, too. There's a photograph of there in the book as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we always talk about Salinger and Cornish, New Hampshire, but Windsor, Vermont was really, I mean, it's you could literally throw a rock from Cornish to Windsor and separated only by a beautiful, really magnificent covered bridge. And Vermont was as much as home as Cornish, New Hampshire. But I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say that I want to get to some other stories about his time in Cornish and certainly in and around Vermont. We're going to take a break right now. We are speaking with Shane Salerno, author of the new book, Salinger, and you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 to join the conversation, 1-800-639-2211. More with Shane Salerno after this break. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, sitting in for Jane Lindholm, and we're talking about J.D. Salinger today with Shane Salerno, author of a new book and documentary about Salinger's life and work. What do you think Salinger's legacy was? What are some of your favorite books, some of your favorite passages from the stories, perhaps? Post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call us at 1-800-639-2211. We have this remark in our Facebook page from Erin, who wrote, as an English teacher, I go back and forth on whether this text is still relevant to today's teens, talking about Catcher in the Rye. Although they may deal with teenage angst differently than Holden, these themes are timeless. Shane Salerno, what about the writing itself? I mean, Catcher in the Rye stands out for so many people. I remember its impact on me when I was in high school and I first read it. And I did have that feeling that I think many readers have, that here is someone who's speaking or at least thinking sometimes the thoughts that I would think and talking about some of the frustrations of being young and coming up against the difficulties of dealing with the adult world. Why did Salinger have such a connection with young people?
I think it's that, in the case of The Catcher in the Rye, I think it's that extraordinary voice, that naked, honest, unmistakable voice that was singular to Salinger and to Holden Caulfield. You don't read that book thinking that he's saying interesting things. You read that book as if he's talking directly to you and knows your inner thoughts and has somehow magically transferred them to his book. And it's a revelation, that book.
We mentioned about his time in Cornish, New Hampshire, and certainly, as you mentioned, it's a stone's throw over to Windsor, Vermont. The people you spoke with in getting this book together in Vermont and New Hampshire, how did they feel about Salinger, and especially how did they feel about protecting his privacy?
They were very serious about protecting his privacy. You know, his desire was not to be part of the press or the media on the one hand, but to, when he wanted to, have a dialogue with the press and the media on the other. Example, in 1974, he spontaneously called the New York Times and granted a 30-minute interview. He met with reporters in 1978 and 79. He traveled the world extensively. He did a lot of very non-reclusive things. He would go to Broadway shows and then pop backstage and pursue the cast and introduce himself to the cast. He would often pursue actresses that he saw on TV in the 1980s, and was very aware of the J.D. Salinger name. In our case, the difficulty was in sorting out this complex and contradictory icon and telling the true and honest story of his life while also being extremely respectful of the amazing work that he gave us all. And what's really interesting is that we were able to convince people to come forward that had kept this silence for so many decades. So in the case of Jean Miller, who was a 14-year-old girl when she met Salinger, and had never told her story. I mean, her name doesn't even appear in a previous Salinger book or newspaper article or magazine. All we had to go on was the letter J, and we had to find J, which was a needle in a stack of needles, as you can imagine, around the country, and not even knowing if she was still alive, and finding this wonderful woman who had an incredible story about meeting Salinger at 14 years old at a pool in Daytona Beach, Florida, and spending time with him from the time she was 14 to the time she was 19, and having over 100 letters from Salinger to her. And it was a very unusual, very strange, and still very special relationship because it was prior to Salinger's worldwide fame with Catcher in the Rye and after, and then prior to Salinger's leaving New York and the literary scene for Cornish, New Hampshire, and after. And, she had a very privileged viewpoint to take you through 5 years of Salinger's life, and had these letters that had never been seen before that were the best evidence that is available, because it's Salinger in his own words. That was a remarkable moment. The second remarkable moment was convincing the Fitzgerald family. Paul Fitzgerald had served with J.D. Salinger since 1944. Had served with J.D. Salinger in 1944 and had maintained a relationship with him from 1944 all the way to 2010. And they had an extraordinary friendship and wrote each other and saw each other over the years. And the Fitzgerald family had over 20 photos of Salinger that had never been seen before, 27. And they also had 20 or so letters from 1944 all the way to 2010 that took you through Salinger's whole life in his own words. And those two people, Jean Miller and Paul Fitzgerald, were remarkable additions to the film and the book.
I have to ask, though, about getting back to Gene Miller for a second, though. I must ask you, is there evidence in what you uncovered there that they had a physical relationship before she was 18?
No, she's very clear that, there's no getting around the fact that it was a strange relationship. It was a non-sexual but romantic relationship from 14 to 18. And then when she was 19, she lost her virginity to Salinger, and tells that story in the film and the book. It was highly unusual because this was a 14-year-old girl who was writing a 30 and 31-year-old man and going to see him in New York and spending, a great deal of time with him. There's no getting around that was an issue with Jean, with Claire Douglas, with Una O'Neill, and with Joyce Maynard. Many years later, it's interesting how Salinger's life came full circle when he lost Una O'Neill, Eugene O'Neill's daughter, to Charlie Chaplin. Chaplin was 54 and Una was 18 when Salinger pursued Joyce Maynard in 1972 after seeing her on the cover of the New York Times Magazine. Salinger was now 54 and she was 18. Mm. So when I say that Una O'Neill imprinted upon him a specific time period, it's something that really stayed with him through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and well into the 1970s.
We've got a call now from Bobby, who's on the line in Starksboro. Hi, Bobby.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. You have a question for Shane Salerno?
I do. So I've been a big fan since I was a teenager, and as I started getting into my early 20s, I got more into the short stories and just consuming it, loving it all, and like did some exploration into his other stuff, like his less is not stuff that wasn't published in books, and was a little less impressed with that earlier writing. And but the other stuff, I kept rereading it. You know, you have your four published books, and I just kept rereading. I've read all of them many, many times. And as I'm reading him, I'm realizing, like, this is it. Is this it? I hear he's writing all the time, and I kept, it's kind of a morbid thought, but I was like, when he dies, I hope he goes quick so he doesn't have a chance to burn his literature or something. I had no idea what would happen to that stuff if there was stuff. So what are the chances? Is there stuff out there that I'm going to get to read that he's been writing over these all these years?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the larger revelations in the book and the film, which made, you know, front page news a few weeks ago, is that over this 10-year journey, we were able to uncover two highly credible individuals, neither of whom spoke to each other, and each of whom had the opportunity to see this work, and each witness provided exactly the same information regarding what work Salinger had scheduled to publish posthumously. So at the end of the film and the end of the book, we actually list what this work is, what it's about, and what he's been doing. I mean, there's no precedent for this in history. I mean, can you imagine a major filmmaker like Steven Spielberg or Terrence Malick making films for 45 years and putting them in a safe to be shown only after their death? Salinger, every single day, went to work. And per his Vedanta religion, he wrote only for himself without seeking any reward. And he took that work and he put it in a safe. And that work has been specifically marked for publication and will begin to be published in irregular installments between 2015 and 2020. And like everyone, I can't wait to read that work. Right now, because he stopped publishing in 1965, not stopped writing, right now we only have half the painting. We only have half of J.D. Salinger's life's work. And what's going to be an extraordinary thing for the world soon is to be able to see the other half of that painting, to see him complete the Glass Family Chronicles, to see him complete the Caulfield Family, of which The Catcher in the Rye and obviously Holden is a part of. And I think that's going to be just something. I just can't even imagine it, really. But that's how he wanted to do it. And if there's one thing clear about J.D. Salinger's life, it's that he does what he wants to do exactly the way he wants to do it.
You mentioned that he stopped publishing in 1965, and it was around that time his last long story that was published in The New Yorker absolutely got skewered by the critics. I mean, whether or not Salinger was wounded by this criticism, it was severe, and you chronicle it very well in this book. I mean, everyone from Norman Mailer to John Updike to Tom Wolfe, people were absolutely saying that this is terrible. He wrote a story that used one of his former characters, Seymour, as a 7-year-old boy writing from summer camp, writing home in a long, long letter, and he writes as though he's speaking like a philosophy professor. I mean, it's very erudite language. He really got slammed for that. How much do you think Salinger cared about that kind of literary criticism from his colleagues?
Well, he cared, and he was very, very aware of it. But it didn't deviate him from the path that he was on. After World War II, he was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, and he desperately was looking for a cure, and he went through Christianity and Buddhism and self-realization fellowship and all of these different religions. And what he ultimately settled on was the Vedanta religion. And that really consumed his life, including, you know, when he passed away, the statement that his family released was, "I am in this world, but not of it." And that was the fulfillment of the fourth tenet of his religion, which is renunciation of the world. And Salinger took to putting Vedanta ideas into his stories. And he had a really good balance for a while. It was about 80% story and character and that exquisite writing, and 20% theology. And that's the number system you sort of see in Franny and Zooey and Raise High and things like that, stories like that. By the time he gets to Hapworth, his last story, the numbers have switched. It's 80-20. It's literally 80% theology, 20% story and character, and 20% maybe being generous. And people just couldn't handle that. They weren't prepared for it, and they didn't believe it. As you said, this 7-year-old boy writing, and I mean, it just wasn't believable to people. Now, when I say we have half the painting, we know as early as 61 and 63 that Salinger wrote that he was writing many more glass stories. So maybe the next story or stories completes Hapworth in such a way as to make it make sense more to the public. And that's what's going to be interesting here. When he finishes the full story of this extraordinary family, will the full painting be the work of that people loved, millions of people loved for decades, or will it be disjointed and lost in theology in the way that Hapworth was? I think that's what everybody's fears are. But I believe in J.D. Salinger as a true fan of his, and I believe he's thought this through for 45 years and is going to have a second act unlike any writer in history.
Mm. You know, we got this comment from Josh who wrote, if someone grew up in a small town and moved to a big city to escape their past, we wouldn't think anything of it. Salinger moved the other way. That's why he stands out, according to Josh. He says, I grew up in Concord, New Hampshire, and have the misfortune to still live there. Apologize to anyone in Concord who's listening. If I could afford it, I'd move to Boston, L.A., emigrate, get lost in a crowd in the city. Salinger got lost in the country. What made him choose Cornish?
Well, that's a great question. He drove all around, and he looked at a number of different places. And when he found this specific 90-acre tract in Cornish, New Hampshire, he fell in love with it. And he used the money that he got paid for The Catcher in the Rye to buy it. And really, it was his sanctuary. It was his. It was the place that gave him great peace. The people of Cornish and Windsor were extremely protective of him. They're a protective community by their very nature. And so he just felt that that was his place. It has very specific connections to the place that he talks about in Catcher in the Rye in some ways, even though he talks about heading out west, some of the ideals of that getaway and escape is what he found in Cornish. And we have a story in the book and in the film of Salinger right after The Catcher in the Rye was published, and he's the toast of New York and everybody wants to meet him, and he gets invited to this big dinner and they push all these tables together as they did back in the day, and all these people are excited and they say, you know, Salinger's really here, he's here. And Salinger sits down and he listens, and everybody's sort of telling him how great he is, and he excuses himself to make a phone call, gets up, and never comes back. And he moved to Cornish, New Hampshire shortly thereafter, and that just wasn't what he wanted. He pursued fame, but when he got it, it wasn't what he wanted at all.
I do have to ask, Shane Salerno, if there's an irony here in that you obviously care a lot about J.D. Salinger. It's coming through in the passion that you have here that as we're speaking to you. It's in the book. Yet you've published a book and made a movie that seeks to reveal a man who at least ostensibly wanted to be left alone. I mean, how do you feel about that? Would Salinger approve?
Well, I don't think he would approve in some ways because there's a story in the film and the book about him not speaking to an editor who put a comma in one of his stories. So he was a perfectionist to a level that I've never seen or read about before. I care deeply about Salinger. I wouldn't have spent a decade of my life on it, let alone $2 million of my own money that I worked for. I didn't inherit it or anything. And I felt that the story of this man's life from Park Avenue to D-Day to, you know, a mental institution to a concentration camp to the woods of New Hampshire had to be told. Many of the people that we interviewed have passed away after we interviewed them. If we hadn't interviewed them when we did, the story would be lost forever. I think that when you understand the cost that it took to produce The Catcher in the Rye over a decade, that those pages not only landed on D-Day but walked into a concentration camp, you have a deeper understanding of that work. When you understand how autobiographical the stories are, you understand the work on a fundamentally deeper level. one of the things that I'm proudest of is, in addition to our book landing, you know, at number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list, which was a really nice thing for us, Salinger's book, The Catcher in the Rye, shot back up to number 7 on Amazon in the last 2 weeks.
Still certainly being read by many, many people. I'm sorry, we'll have to leave it there. We're running out of time. Shane Salerno, author of the new book, Salinger, and the documentary about his life and work. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Have you ever planned to motor west? Travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Well, for the last couple of days, we've been getting our kicks on Vermont State Route 66. Unlike the iconic U.S. highway of the same number that stretches halfway across the country, the Vermont version runs from East Randolph to Randolph, all of 10 miles long. VPR's Rick Sengary spent time touring the state road and today gives us some guidance on how to stay up on the local gossip when traveling on this well-numbered piece of asphalt.
Okay, can I get a coffee and a donut?
If you're looking for coffee and an earful about what's happening around Randolph, your first stop needs to be Floyd's General Store. It sits next to the Randolph Center Post Office, right where Route 66 takes a sharp 90-degree turn.
Don't worry. You're going to help me out here, Al.
Well, I agree with you. We need some.
Here, every morning, a group gathers in the back of the store to solve the world's problems, or at least Randolph's problems. In quieter moments, Al Floyd, owner of the store, can give you glimpses of the Route 66 of the past.
This is the way Randolph was. Really, in 63 when we moved here, a few houses and wasn't that much truck. As a matter of fact, the people that owned that brick house, Mathers, they had a dog named Bunky, and he would lay on that yellow line and go to sleep. People would drive around him. That's how much traffic went through here. Now we have traffic. We have 5 or 6 cars stopped, piled up there in the morning, a traffic jam.
And no trip to Randolph and Route 66 for the local lowdown is complete without a visit with Mim Herwig.
Here you've reached the pinnacle. This little village aspired to be the state capital.
Now 90 years old, Mim knows the history of the area very well.
And they cited a place for the state house to be. It was in Judge Tarbox's sheep pasture at that time. And as an inducement, they built the house next door as a governor's mansion. We still call it that. But no governor ever lived here, of course. But there was one day when Randolph Center was capital, and few people remember that now, but that was during the Cold War.
It was 1957. The idea was to conduct a drill, moving Governor Joe Johnson and his staff to an undisclosed location. That turned out to be Judd Hall in Randolph Center.
For one day, we had the glory of being capital and none of the worries.
The governor's mansion that never housed a Vermont governor still stands just a few hundred yards off of Route 66 in Randolph Center. The next stop is in downtown Randolph at Ken's Barbershop, where Gary Chapman cuts hair.
You know, everything's going on in town, and it's a lot of fun. I said that we ought to do a reality show on the barbershop.
How much is a haircut?
I've been doing this, it'll be 50 years. I started at $1 a haircut. 50 years later, I'm getting 10 to 12. That's progress. That's progress.
Tom Jacobs is owner of the barbershop. It was started by his dad, Ken.
Can you recommend a good barber in the area?
Yeah. Drive down to South Carlton, and he'll give you directions.
Well, it used to be a music store here, and located right here on Main Street. It's a great setting for the barbershop. We don't always have the facts, but we always have a story.
By the way, you'll know you've made it to Ken's Barbershop when you see the mountain lion in the front window. That's right. For VPR News, I'm Rick Sengary.
And that's it for today. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, the Vermont apple season has begun, so we'll head to the orchards to taste the varieties that are ripe and ready for picking, eating, and baking. And we'll learn about heirloom varieties and about the wild apples growing in our forests. Send your apple questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Thank you so much for listening.